From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
A new report puts another spotlight on so-called Havana syndrome, a set of mysterious symptoms being reported by U.S. government security and diplomatic personnel around the world. As No Labels ends its bid for a 2024 unity ticket as an alternative to President Biden and Donald Trump after failing to attract a candidate. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, columnist Alicia Finley and editorial board member Mene Ukwe-Barua. Havana syndrome has been an issue that has been talked about for years now through the Trump administration, as well as the Biden administration. But let's start with a couple clips from a recent 60 Minutes report bringing some new information to light. And the first one here, this is an FBI agent who is being identified using the name Carrie, who says that she was hit with this Havana syndrome when she was at home in Florida in 2021.
Inside my right ear, it was like a dentist drilling on steroids. That feeling when it gets too close to your eardrum, it's like that, you know, times 10. It was like a high-pitched metallic drilling noise, and it knocked me forward at like a 45-degree angle this way.
She says she was by a window in her laundry room.
My right ear was line of sight to that window while this thing was happening in my ear. I immediately felt pressure, and pressure and pain started coursing from inside my right ear, down my jaw, down my neck, and into my chest.
At the same time, FBI agent Carrie told us, the battery in her phone began to swell until it broke the case. Finally, she passed out on a couch.
I felt like I had early Alzheimer's. Short-term memory, long-term memory, confusing memories, multitasking. My baseline changed. I was not the same person.
And here's a clip of attorney Mark Zaid, who represents multiple agents of the FBI, the CIA, and employees of the State Department who say they were hit with similar symptoms.
There are dozens of CIA cases that have happened domestically that is at least believed. And we're not even just talking about physical manifestation. We're talking about evidence of computer issues in the midst of the incident where computer screens just literally stop working or go flicker on and off. There are other FBI agents and personnel, not just agents, analysts. I represent one other FBI person who was impacted in Miami. And I also know of FBI personnel who believe they were hit overseas in the last decade. The one thread that I know of with the FBI personnel that is common among most, if not all, of my clients, other than the family members connected to the employee, was they were all doing something relating to Russia.
Alicia, what do you make of this? The Journal's editorial board recently wrote a piece saying that the 60 Minutes report should prompt some more answers from the government, that it has been too dismissive of these claims. What's your view of this, and what do we know actually about this Havana syndrome?
So the Havana syndrome is actually dubbed that, or gets its name after it was discovered or documented that government personnel at the U.S. Embassy in Cuba in 2016 started suffering these kind of mysterious neurological symptoms and conditions, tinnitus, which is ringing in the ear, vertigo, headache, dizziness, cognitive dysfunction, to the point that the FBI agent just mentioned feeling like lapses in short-term memory, like similar to Alzheimer's. And more victims over the years started reporting similar symptoms, and they spanned different government agencies. There was a Commerce Department official that was involved in diplomacy, FBI, CIA, a lot of them involved in intelligence, but many of them were also involved in looking at Russia or involved in Russian affairs. And so the U.S. government has commissioned a number of reports in the intelligence agencies, the intelligence bureaucracy, which, by the way, spans many agencies in the government, have commissioned reports and study this. And those that at least have come out have basically said, oh, there's nothing to see here. We can't really pin down or identify a cause, but it's probably unlikely to be due to any kind of foreign adversary, notwithstanding all the circumstantial evidence suggesting that. They're basically saying because the effects or the symptoms of the intelligence officers, and again, there are some 1,500 cases now that have been reported, the symptoms are kind of diffuse and the biological studies that have been done, you know, we can't really pin down any actually neurological damage, that therefore, you know, maybe it's all in their heads, like the Salem witch trials, and actually they've gotten some support from that from some social psychologists who say that this is basically just mass hysteria.
There's a recent report from the National Institutes of Health that looked at about 80 of these cases. And here is reading from the NIH news release. Using advanced imaging techniques and in-depth clinical assessments, a research team at the National Institutes of Health found no significant evidence of MRI-detectable brain injury nor differences in most clinical measures compared to controls among a group of federal employees who experienced anomalous health incidents, AHIs, which is how this is often referred to in government documents. And Manet, one theory that's being advanced is that these attacks could be the result of some kind of Russian energy weapon. And on one hand, I would not put anything past Vladimir Putin if we find out in some years that there have been attacks by Russian agents on U.S. personnel using some kind of secret weapon that Russia developed. I don't think that I would be surprised in the least. On the other hand, people have all sorts of strange health episodes throughout their lives. People have all sorts of opinions about their health that we might call medically unorthodox. And if you have hundreds of thousands of people working for the government, maybe, who are concerned that they hear these stories and they think that any day they might be hit by some kind of Russian ray, they might have an unrelated health event, a mini stroke or something like that, and they might think that was it. This is what I have been waiting for. And by the way, these are not mutually exclusive explanations. You could have one group of people who was actually attacked using some kind of Russian weapon, and you could have another group of people who had some sort of normal health event, mental health crisis, and those people think they were attacked by the same Russian weapon. And so it gets pretty difficult to tease out what is actually going on here.
I think that's true. It is really difficult to put together all of the testimonies of these people who claim to have experienced these attacks and sort them into the most credible accounts, and also to establish a definitive record of what might this be. I think if you look at the NIH reports, they do say that the MRIs that were applied to some of these people who reported being attacked by this supposed device didn't reveal any definitive sign of stroke or severe trauma. And I think that that, on the one hand, is revealing about what the nature of the injury might be. It isn't causing some kind of clear physical damage to the brain tissue of these people. But I don't think that that necessarily invalidates the notion that there could be some kind of temporary physical effect that's taking place from some kind of energy pulse directed at these people, which is affecting their brains in some way, making them experience a temporary spike of sensation, and then possibly leading to some kind of disorientation that just isn't related to a hard physical injury on their brain tissue. And so I would hope that the studies are continuing, that there are methods of investigating this beyond MRI technology. But I do think that there's reason to think that it isn't merely mass hysteria. I think that there are instances, certainly in history, when you've had the general public understanding that there's an illness going around, being wary of it, and then starting to read too much into their own symptoms and self-diagnose. There are instances when that has happened through broadcast, etc. But I think that it's very rare to have, among a relatively small group of trained, credentialed experts all reporting these symptoms, particularly when a disproportionate number of them do have the connection to Russia in terms of what their portfolio was. There seems to be enough evidence that these people are credible. Those testimonies that we heard in the clips sound very credible, I think, to the average listener. And so the government should be leaning in the direction of trusting its own employees. And even if there isn't anything hard documented in terms of what they're experiencing, should be continuing the search, treating it very seriously, and preparing to retaliate if we do have evidence to link it to Russian attacks.
Hang tight. We'll be right back in a moment.
Rapid expansion?
We're ready.
Worker shortage?
We're good.
Anything can change the world of work.
A celebrity buys the company.
Depends on who it is. But relax, we've got ADP.
From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
Welcome back. A couple things that come to mind on the point about getting more information out, and especially more information from the government. One is the allegations, including those that you heard in those clips we played from 60 Minutes, of electronic and physical changes to a cell phone battery or a computer screen, something like that, that is reportedly coming along with these physical effects, because that's something that could shed light on what's going on here. And notable to me that there was a claim that there was an effect on a cell phone, and the 60 Minutes report, as far as I saw, did not show the cell phone or provide any more backup on that. Two is, Alicia, if there is some sort of energy weapon that is being deployed against U.S. personnel, I start to wonder whether there are similar reports in Ukraine, in Germany, in the U.K., places where Russian agents have committed or attempted assassinations, or among Russian dissidents. I mean, I know our intelligence and reporting out of that country is limited in some respects, but I imagine if Russia has some kind of secret weapon that we're unaware of, that it would be deployed against other people other than American agents.
I think that that's very possible. And the Russians, on the other hand, could just be gaslighting the Americans and saying, see, this is what we could do if you guys escalate in some fashion. And just going back to that National Institutes of Health study, there were numerous shortcomings in this study and that were actually pointed out in an accompanying editorial in the journal American Medical Association. And for one, just because there was no actual damage shown on the MRIs in the brain, that doesn't necessarily mean that there wasn't actual physical damage that was done. In fact, many of these scans were taken over years after the symptom onset. And what we know is that when there's brain damage, for instance, from a concussion, actually, that doesn't always necessarily show up months or years later, even though there is actual damage done. There are certain actually blood proteins that can measure. And in fact, what they have found in other studies is that many of these victims have actually shown a spike in these certain proteins that do evince damage. We also know that if there were some kind of energy weapon, an electromagnetic pulse, which is now one of the culprits that is being speculated, that can affect all kinds of neurological sensations, neurological symptoms. And we know that because there are actually scientists who are studying how to use these kind of electromagnetic impulses to actually treat various conditions without actually doing damage to the brain. But we do know that this is a plausible explanation, notwithstanding the NIH's studies, which I think were kind of not just flawed, but really just kind of dismissive of these patients' concerns. And I think we've seen that in other contexts where the NIH also mentioned that long COVID and chronic fatigue syndrome are a couple of other areas in which they haven't necessarily been able to pin down an exact cause in the NIH despite studying this. But nonetheless, there are patients clearly suffering physical symptoms of something, and more study is really warranted, just like there is here.
But on the point about whether the government owes the public more information, Manet, it wouldn't be the first time to find out after the fact that the government was not telling the entire truth, didn't want to follow the leads down the path and find out information that would be alarming to Americans, alarming to American personnel, might make people feel like we are more vulnerable to some of our adversaries than most people feel going about their daily lives.
Absolutely. I think that the investigation into the origins of COVID is actually a good comparable story, in the sense that there was very clear evidence early on when it became clear that COVID originated in Wuhan, which is where the Institute of Virology in China is, that it likely had some amount of government involvement on the part of China. And yet we rarely did see the federal investigators take that very seriously, at least in the public eye. And part of that is probably knowing that they don't want to have to engage in the difficult diplomacy of actually holding China accountable for its actions And obviously part of it also is the American complicity on the part of Anthony Fauci and some of these other public health administrators who might have participated in funding or at least sponsoring some of the research that was done. And so there is certainly a precedent for the government being unwilling to look down certain paths because they fear what they'll be held accountable for doing if the truth becomes known. And it's possible that they don't want to be faced with the opportunity of having to retaliate or having to admit that we've been unable to protect our own personnel against the Russian threat.
Hang tight. We'll be right back after one more break.
ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kind of heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Let's turn to some political news. The polling suggests that many American voters are not satisfied with the 2024 presidential choice, that they're being offered a rematch between President Biden and Donald Trump. And for months, the group No Labels has been saying that it will get together a unity ticket and it will run that unity ticket only if it thinks that there is a path to win. And on Thursday, they threw in the towel. Here is a piece of the statement. Americans remain more open to an independent presidential run and hungrier for unifying national leadership than ever before. But No Labels has always said we would only offer our ballot line to a ticket if we could identify candidates with a credible path to winning the White House. No such candidates emerged, so the responsible course of action for us is to stand down. Let's listen to a piece of No Labels National Director Joe Cunningham in an interview with Neil Cavuto on Fox News.
No Labels was looking for a hero, and a hero never emerged. We've been very straightforward and upfront and honest with the American public that we were going to field this ticket if two conditions are met. Number one, if Americans wanted another option, which is definitely a box that's checked. And number two, if we're able to find candidates that we believe have a pathway to victory. And that's where we ran into a bit of trouble, is at the end of the day, we weren't able to find candidates that we felt had a straightforward path to victory in this.
Monet, what do you make of this and what it says about our political system and the political moment that we're in?
I think that it was clear to the organizers of No Labels, as it was clear to just about everyone paying attention to the presidential race, that there's massive dissatisfaction with the two options who are going to top the Democratic and Republican Party tickets. And so they believed it was the ripest possible opportunity to field a credible third-party candidacy. But I think what they probably overlooked and what has become even clearer as time has gone on is that Americans really still are baked into their respective political camps, perhaps more because of opposing the other party than supporting their own party or supporting the candidate of their own party. But there isn't really a huge persuadable middle out there. It might be larger than it's been in past election cycles, but it's still not gaping wide. And another thing that we've seen over the past few months is the emergence of Robert Kennedy Jr. as a viable candidate, not in the sense of really having a path toward winning the presidency, but in the sense of having gained ballot access in about six states so far and polling really highly. He has about 11% of popular support nationally, or at least in important swing states. And so he has already carved out a lot of that third party support that theoretically could have gone to a No Labels candidate. And so I think that a lot of these people who they were speaking to about the possibility of running under their mantle thought that the only thing that I will do if I run is to be a spoiler, because there it just isn't as much room for me to build a large base of support. Probably not enough room for me to actually win a single state, and the possibility of me just tipping the election in one way or another, and specifically, I think, tipping the election to Donald Trump seemed to be a very high possibility for them, which they believed, I think, would give them the legacy of having threatened American democracy. That's exactly what the press would say. That's exactly what Democratic elites would say. And they were very shy about the possibility of having that effect on the presidential race.
What I would add to that is the Electoral College requires majority winners. That's in the 12th Amendment to the Constitution. Presidential and vice presidential candidates need a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. And what that means is even if you can get a third party stood up and you can do all of the work to get on a whole bunch of ballots, No Label says it had qualified for 21 ballots, and maybe it could have gotten more by the time the presidential voting started, but that is a long way from 50. And even if you can win a bunch of states, if you can't win a majority of the Electoral College, then you send the presidential election to Congress. And there is not a congressional delegation from No Labels. In Congress, it's all Republicans and it's all Democrats. This is the two-party system that we have. The rules are set up and they channel voters into one of two major parties. That is how it has been throughout American history. And there are some advantages to that. We do not have the kind of fractured political coalitions that you see in some places with parliaments, where they have an election and then they spend a lot of time after that wrangling, trying to get together a governing coalition because there are several or a dozen parties in the parliament. You know, that has its own drawbacks. But Monet, one thing that I would also add is that I don't think No Labels is wrong about the hunger among a broad chunk of the electorate for another option. This is the recent February Harvard-Harris poll. The question is, do you think if Joe Biden and Donald Trump are the nominees of their parties, that the country needs another alternative, or that this is a good choice for the voters? And 62% of people say that the country needs another choice. And I sometimes get emails from readers and listeners saying, well, how can that be true? How can that poll be right? If you look at the primary results and Donald Trump and Joe Biden are winning 80 or 90% of their respective parties. And the answer is that the share of voters that are participating in these party primaries is actually pretty low. And in some of the caucus states, it's something like 10%. So it can be true that Donald Trump is beloved by Republicans, and it can be true that Joe Biden is beloved by many Democrats, and you still have 40% of the voters who are independents who are not making their voices heard in those processes.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And something I'd add to that is that the incentives for the leading candidates of both parties often are to cater to their own respective bases in their own approach to policy and campaigning. I think that President Biden probably has seen the polls of late that have shown him losing to Donald Trump in just about all of the major swing states, 6 out of 7 in the recent Wall Street Journal poll. And that would suggest to his campaign advisors that they should be telling him, you need to reach out for the center. You need to reach out for some of those Republican voters who are clearly dissatisfied with Donald Trump, who should be winnable for him. And yet he has even stronger incentives to continue governing in a way that caters to the left within his own party. You've seen him, for example, within the past couple of months, ban exports of liquid natural gas. That's something that is going to be really dispiriting to a lot of voters in the middle of the country who are not necessarily deeply committed Republican voters, but who work in practical industries that depend on efficient energy. But you still see that on the one hand, the majoritarian structure of the American electoral system should be encouraging candidates to reach for the middle. But the way that our politics is organized makes that very difficult or very unrewarding for these candidates to do for one reason or another. And so you have this large group who should be winnable voters in the middle, but who end up, because the difference is so stark between a very progressive president on one hand and a very culturally conservative candidate in Donald Trump on the other hand, these voters end up retreating to one camp or the other in order to stop the opponent from being elected. And so there doesn't really seem to be very much ability for a third party candidate to come and cater to that demand, despite the fact that it's very large in the middle of the country.
Thank you, Monet and Alicia. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.